First, I want to find out, since we're approaching a legislative session, what your plans are for the upcoming session.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me yet again, a third time. So for this upcoming session, because it's a 30-day session and it's focused mainly on budget, our primary goal will be to get our budget increased. And the reason for that is that, as we spoke about on several other occasions, the Legislative Finance Committee did an evaluation of domestic violence services and came up with some recommendations. And many of those recommendations involve the need to train people, to supervise them, and to be able to pay them what is required. What we're asking people to do, right, is to protect victims from violence and to end the violence of offenders. And that requires that people have education, experience, and training. And so we're going to ask our legislators to increase the amount of funding that we get to be able to do that.
Maybe you could give us kind of an idea of where we are in terms of, do you have any kind of figures of how prevalent domestic violence is in New Mexico, how much of a problem, and what kind of services we have?
So I guess what I'd like to say is that it's a big problem, and any numbers I give you will be undoubtedly grossly underestimated in terms of the actual number of cases. It's a very expensive problem for us in New Mexico. If we were to be, each domestic violence incident, for example, costs about, on average, $50,000. So if we could reduce domestic violence by just a little, right, the cost savings, not to mention the emotional cost savings, would be astronomical.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've ever heard that figure before. And I should have said, as you say in your book, you say, we're not talking about domestic violence, we're talking about abusers, that we have to focus on the fact that it's people doing this. It's not an idea up there in the stratosphere someplace.
Philosopher and author Hannah Arendt once said, she was talking at that time about Nazi Germany, she said, where all are guilty, none is. And I think that one of the mistakes we've made in the domestic violence field is that we talk about domestic violence as if it's an entity, or we talk about patriarchy or sexism. But in fact, those are ideas. And by naming names, which is very difficult to do, particularly when people have a lot of power, by naming names, we make those ideas tangible and real. And I think that's what we have to do. Domestic violence doesn't cause anything. Domestic violence offenders do. Mm-hmm. Patriarchy doesn't cause domestic violence. Domestic violence offenders cause it. So I think that what we've seen with the hashtag MeToo is that people have come around to seeing that, right? They're actually naming names. They are coming out, they're saying who committed what kinds of acts against them. And so when there are real consequences for real people, then we begin to see change. But when we talk in these abstract, sort of esoteric terms, people can pretend they didn't hear it and write it off. So I'm encouraged about what's been happening.
Okay. You're encouraged by what's been happening nationally, but are we making progress in New Mexico?
I believe that we are making progress in New Mexico. However, here's my concern, and that is that when people can see plain as day that not only are there no consequences for behaving abusively, as we've seen with many of our national leaders, absent the hashtag MeToo phenomena, there is a kind of permission given to others to do the same, right? If our president can commit an act of domestic abuse, then what's to stop other people from doing it? And one of the things that we know when we look at the behavior of batterers is that if a batterer is arrested and not really held to account, if a judge says, oh, you know, I guess you didn't mean to do it, you know, no consequences for you, then it is more likely that they will commit that act again rather than less likely. You'd be better off to not mention it at all than to bring it up and to demonstrate to people that, to dismiss it, to demonstrate that there are no consequences. If we want to see change, there has to be, the first step have to be consequences. It doesn't have to be jail forever, but it has to be something. That can't be overstated.
Okay. Okay, so that sort of brings us to your book. We kind of were leading to it when we talked before, because we talked about batter as an invention, and then we started talking about how there's a lot of parallels between what is happening politically, or between politicians who have been seen in abusive terms. You can define what their actions are through abuse, and that's what you've sort of done in your book. And the name of the book is Not the Usual Suspects: Beyond the Batterer, Abusive Power in Politics. So you use domestic violence as kind of a lens to look at political abuse.
Exactly. It occurred to me, actually, quite a few years ago, that the behavior of batterers, their motivations, their intents, the effects were all very similar. And it occurred to me that what the motive really was, what the objective is in both categories, whether it's politicians who use power abusively or the domestic abuser, the objective is total control. And that's the context. And we can't forget that, right? There are incidents every day, particularly now, in terms of the behavior of our politicians, and each one, were we to look at it individually, might not seem so horrendous. We could write it off. And the same is true with domestic violence, right? Someone may be slapped or pushed down or whatever, but what we forget is that there's a context. And the context and the objective is to gain and maintain control over someone else by any means, right? And sometimes those means include violence, and sometimes there are other tactics used in pursuit. But the goal of abusive power, which has been used, I would say, nationally quite effectively over the last decade or so, is to be able to maintain control.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the techniques that you go into in the book. Sure. And the one that is particularly stands out is lying. And we might as well talk about Trump, because that is in the book, and that's sort of the prime example. And I think people can't understand how he could lie so much, and no one does anything about it. No one responds to it, or some people try to, but it just doesn't seem, no one sort of stands up and says, wait a minute here.
So the first thing I just want to say is that this book is not a book about Donald Trump, and the majority of it was written before he ever appeared on the scene. Mm-hmm. However, he is the epitome, really, of abusiveness. He's a perfect example, the personification of what we're talking about. However, when he's gone, I think abusive power will still be there. So that's a little caveat. I worked with domestic abusers for many years. And we talk about their being in denial. That's a common phrase. And I used to think, what does that mean, in denial? That they don't know that they did it? Or are they just lying about it, right? So they can keep from being accountable. Lots of counselors behaved, I think, as if they thought somehow he just didn't realize that happened, you know? So abuser might say, and did say, I don't know what happened, but first thing I knew, my wife was flying out the door. It's like, wow, she flew out the door? How did that happen, right? I'm not really sure, right? So is that denial or is it a lie? In fact, I think it's time that we be clear about this, right? There's a lot of lying going on, and the purpose is to avoid accountability for really terrible behavior. That's full stop.
You're not saying that this is just Trump who's doing it. You're saying that in people who are just going for power and more power.
Right. The lies and denials are typical of people who use power abusively. It's ironic because victims of domestic violence occasionally fight back. And when they do, they tend to admit it. So they'll go before the court. The court will say, what happened? And the victim will say, well, I threw a shoe at him, Your Honor, after he'd been, you know, torturing her for 3 days. And the abuser would say, I never touched her, Your Honor. I never did anything. So then there's the judge. He has an admission of guilt, and he has someone who's denying everything. And what's he going to do with that, right? The only thing that can be done is to punish the person who admitted it and to let hook the person who denied it, because there's no smoking gun. There's no evidence, which is often the case. And that's precisely what we see going on right now. There are people who are admitting and apologizing to bad behavior, who are being punished, railroaded, run out of town. And then there are those people who are in complete denial, who are getting away with it.
Well, as I was reading your book and realized that you were using domestic violence, your experience with domestic violence, to sort of make some predictions about what could happen and to analyze the situation, I found it, as I told you when we first started, I found it depressing, because domestic violence is so hard to deal with, and we haven't really made very good inroads with it, and to apply that to our political situation is depressing. But you talk about things that we can do. You make suggestions about how we can deal with this.
Yes, before we become too helpless, hopeless, and powerless, right, we ought to have some good news. And I think that there is some. One piece of good news, I think, is, as I mentioned, the idea that we are organizing. The Women's March after Trump's election was astounding. I think many of us were so happy and relieved that that happened. A display of commitment and power like we hadn't seen before. People are naming names, right? And that's important. We're not talking in abstract terms anymore about, oh, domestic violence or abuse. We are talking about actual people who are committing actual crimes, and we are asking for accountability for those people. So that's part of it. We also, domestic violence is often normalized, and we like to talk, in fact, about how common it is. We'll go out and speak to a, you know, a civic group and imply that most of the women in that room are probably being abused or have been. The problem with that is that it's not really the case, and where all are guilty, none is. If everyone's doing it, it's kind of a norm, and then it therefore must be okay. In fact, there are a select group of people, and I would argue that really kind of a smallish group. It might seem like it's everyone, but I don't think it is everyone, who are committing these acts and who are, in essence, not to put too fine a point on it, but destroying our national culture. And we need to do something about that, right? So we have to figure out who those people are, we have to expose them, and then we have to take action. We don't want to say everyone does it because everyone doesn't do it, and then that just gives everyone more permission.
Okay, that leads me to two questions that I had. One of them, I want you to talk about what you say with domestic violence can actually happen. So we want to give people the good news, but let's give them the bad news too. And the second question is, do you think if we get more women into political office that things will change?
Yes, I do think things will change if we get more women into political office, and thank goodness that's happening. So the thing about domestic violence is that ultimately families collapse. So what the domestic violence offender might want, which is total control, is very rarely the thing that he achieves. Families where there is domestic violence often disintegrate under the impact of it, and the abuser loses whatever it was that he was hoping he might get. So I think one of the intents and the effects of domestic violence is a perpetual inequality where the abusive person seeks to ensure that he keeps power and control and a sense of superiority over his family. And all of his actions can be viewed as in pursuit of those ends. I think something that we forget about is that in this case, as we see our national leaders doing the same, we all get perplexed about it. And we say things like, oh, that's a double standard, or, right, which, and those are ubiquitous, right, or that's a projection. But people who act abusively couldn't care less that we say that, because for them, and I think this is really important, this is war. And the objective is total control, to conquer and to win by whatever means. And just as in a war, you wouldn't say, oh, but they were so hypocritical, or they, you know, the saying goes, all is fair in love and war. I believe that is the perspective that these people hold. And I think for us to forget about that and for us to say, wait, but you're not, that's not right. You shouldn't do those things. The fact is, it doesn't matter to them because the ends justify the means, and that's something we can't forget. And the same is true of abusers. Abusers will use violence if that's what they need to do, but if they can achieve total control by some other means, then they will do that. So we have to really look at the overall big picture about what they are attempting to do. As we sort of parse and take apart the individual actions and behaviors, which many of us are appalled by, but if we look at them in terms of the overall impact, that's the objective.
Talk a little bit about how abusers think that they've got to have control and why. You talk about two different things. You talk about abusers having to have a control, and then you talk about politically, the strict father, which has been already sort of explained by Lakoff, I guess.
Yeah. Right. George Lakoff, who is he's a cognitive linguist, I hope I got that right, wrote a number of years ago about conservatives and liberals and how they differ in terms of their beliefs. One of the ways in which conservatives view the world is that being a strict father is important. So not helping people, not allowing people to be dependent, making them sort of pull themselves up by the bootstraps, that's how you create strong people. And I've heard abusers in my group say that over and over. I was raised harshly, so I'm going to raise my kids harshly. It didn't hurt me, you know, not right, not counting the fact that you are in an abuser group. But the fact is that we know that the strict father does not lead to healthy, strong, happy people. It leads to people who are fearful, who are angry, who are traumatized. There is almost nothing worse for a family or for our culture than engaging and expressing that kind of a belief. As Lakoff says, there's kind of a dominance hierarchy, right? The important thing is to be on top, and the dominance hierarchy is men are over women, and white people are over minorities, and all those are over children and over animals and so on. And the goal and the objective for people who have been raised that way is to make sure that everybody stays in their places. And I think we can see how that's been working. It occurs to me that it works that way, particularly when it comes to control of resources. I had a man in group once who was complaining because his wife used to shop at the dollar store. And she would buy these, like literally, right? Everything costs a dollar. These little dollar figurines, right? Trying to like dress up the house, I guess. And he thought that was a complete waste of money, and he was furious about it, and he threw them against the wall, and he broke them. And yet he, on the other hand, bought things like four-wheelers, and he would gamble. So he spent a lot of the family's money, and she was begrudged these minor, meager little purchases, right? Like a dollar store figurine. But in his mind, as in the minds, I think, of our current political leadership, that was fine because he was deserving and she wasn't. And he intended to control the resources because he thought he should and he could, and she wasn't worth it, really, in his mind. And I think that's what we've seen, right, with our new so-called tax reform bill, right, where we had senators saying, one senator, Grassley from Iowa, said during a hearing that they wanted to give money to very rich people because they would invest it when everybody else who they might think of giving money to would just spend that money foolishly, such as on booze, women, and movies. So there's this idea that people who don't need the money but who are going to get it can justify that to themselves because nobody else is really worthy. And I think that's exactly what happens in domestic violence homes. Victims don't have access to money. They have to justify everything they spend, right? Yes, I had to buy, you know, school clothes for Johnny, right? And that's questioned. She doesn't question his expenditures, four-wheelers and, you know, gambling weekends, but he gets to question hers. And so I think there's an exact parallel between those things.
You point out that children who are brought up in households with the strict father don't become stronger themselves, even though the father may think that that's the way they do it.
Right. No, they don't become stronger. They become frightened and angry, and they are also more likely to perpetrate violence on other people, right? So it's a way, if you want to really recreate this abusive sort of power dynamic, then that's what you would want to do. And we see that, again, with our politicians all the time. People ought to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, right? We're not going to give people money that they haven't actually earned or that they don't, you know, deserve in some way, thinking that that's going to make them stronger people. And in fact, it does the opposite.
You also talk in the book about something that people have been sort of talking about for a while now, but not doing anything about, really, and that's how different parts of society are growing further and further apart, and we have the haves and have-nots, and the discrimination is getting bigger.
One of the things we know about inequality is that in places where there is greater inequality, there is more hopelessness, there's more depression, there's less altruism, people are less likely to be engaged in their communities. Nothing is worse for a society, really, than inequality, and of course, we're about to make that very much worse. The same is true in families, right, where inequality is allowed to be maintained. Those families are not strong, they are weak, they are traumatized, and a lot of opportunity is lost. I think the important thing to say also about inequality is that it isn't just the people who are unequal who suffer. In areas where the inequality is greater, whether you're a have or you're a have not, you are subject to those kinds of effects. Depression, illness, hopelessness, anger, lack of altruism, lack of empathy, all of those really awful conditions affect people just because they live in unequal societies. And our abusive politicians may think that they can divorce themselves from those consequences, that they can sort of live behind in their gated communities. But in fact, that's really not true. And I think that they will discover that the sort of world they create for the rest of us is the one that they're going to have to live into.
We're talking about a book called Not the Usual Suspects by Pamela Jane, which is Pam Wiseman's pseudonym and was the pseudonym for her first book, Ditch That Jerk, dealing with men who control and abuse women, sort of more specifically dealing with domestic violence. Who's your audience? Who do you want to read this book?
So I had a lot of trouble with that, of course. So I'm hoping that people who work in domestic violence will read it. And the reason I want them to read it is because I want us to fully appreciate how much we know about power imbalances and what they do to families and what they are doing to our culture. We're experts in this, right? We've seen it firsthand, and I think we have a lot to offer, both in terms of understanding how it works and what we can do about it. But I'm also hoping that people who have been upset, which is many of us, and who felt hopeless and powerless and helpless in the face of this sort of burgeoning abuse of power, will find something therapeutic in it and some ideas about what they can do differently. I think there's something that we talk about in the field of domestic violence called learned helplessness, right? And I think many people have heard of that. When no action that you take seems to produce the desired outcome, you just give up, right? And we know that to be true. And so for many of us in this country, right, 60% of us, 70% of us, 80% of us, depending on the issue, might want something that never comes to pass. It seems like no matter what we do, the abusive politicians do whatever occurs to them, and as if we didn't matter. And that is demoralizing, and that's depressing, and that results in our paralysis. That's why I think it's so important that we're applying pressure, that we're speaking out, that we're talking to other people. And I think other things that we need to do are to avoid placating or trying to appease these people. There's a man named Tim Snyder. He's a Yale professor of, I believe, political science. He wrote a great book, a little tiny book called On Tyranny, where he outlines the ways in which a totalitarianism could descend upon us and how it's happened before. And one of the issues he talks about is something called anticipatory obedience. But it means sort of figuring out what someone in power wants and doing it before they even ask you to do it. And that is certainly what victims of domestic violence do, right? It's like, oh, he's going to come home, he's going to be drunk, I better, you know, make this for dinner, whatever it is, right? Always placating and anticipating. And that does nothing but embolden people. Now, maybe I should say that for victims of domestic violence, they know what they're doing and it keeps them safe, but it also keeps them stuck, and they have to do that forever, just as we're going to have to do that for a long time, too, if we don't simply stand up to it. And I think a lot of people are feeling that they can stand up to it. And like many bullies, right? When that happens, they stop. With victims of domestic violence, they find people almost always side with the abuser, right? They support the abuser, and they denigrate and demean and demoralize the victim, or they don't believe the victim. And so victims become often hysterical in a way, right? Because these terrible things are happening to them, and not only do people not believe them, but nobody sticks up for them, save domestic violence advocates. And that's what we're seeing here too, right? That injustice that is pervasive. Terrible things are happening, and I think many of us in this country feel that, where are our friends? Where are the people who should be standing up and saying, this is wrong? Why aren't they doing it, right? And so we could turn that in on ourselves and become powerless, or we could fight back.
Okay. The name of the book is Not the Usual Suspects. I know you can get it through Amazon. Mm-hmm. Where else can you get it?
I believe it's in various bookstores, and mm-hmm. but certainly Amazon is. So there is the overall objective, which, as I said, is total control. And there are the terrible effects that people who are seeking total control create in those people they are trying to control. But there are also a lot of tactics, and I think it's important to recognize them as tactics. So, for example, one tactic is, I think I called it stealth, and that simply means trying to conceal who you are and what you're trying to do so that people get confused about it, and they think, oh, it's all the same, right? And I'm thinking of, like, some of the older examples might be, you know, calling an initiative the Healthy Forest Initiative, which is really about cutting down trees so the logging industry can make more money, or the Healthy Skies Initiative, which is about allowing more pollution, right? It's a very sort of Orwellian kind of approach to keeping people from understanding what's really going on. The Koch brothers and those like them, right, have spent a lot of money recruiting just regular folks, right, putting them on buses and taking them out to protest something. And the sort of most iconic image, right, was a woman who had been brought out for a little Tea Party rally, who was holding a sign that said, keep your government hands off my Medicare, right? Just to suggest that, you know, people don't really know who it is they're supporting. And there's been a concerted effort to make sure that we never do. Some other tactics, a primary tactic of domestic abusers is to say there are two sides, right? It's a he said, she said, and we see that all over the place, right? There might be two scientists that say, oh, there's, you know, no such thing as global warming, but they're given equal time as if it were a legitimate perspective. And the same thing happens with abusers. And when there's no obvious smoking gun, then that tactic is allowed to reign. I think controlling information is probably the most insidious tactic, and we've seen that to a significant degree. The governor of Maine, Paul LePage, said recently, the sooner the press goes away, the better it will be for society, which is fairly mild compared to what his colleagues and friends have said and are trying to do to keep us from getting good information. But that's what abusers will say. Don't listen to those other people. Don't believe them, right? I'm the only one who understands you. I'm the only one who can help you. And after hearing that long enough, people may tend to believe it. And that's what we're seeing now, right? The press is all wrong. It's fake news. I think in this case, the president, some of his, again, his friends are saying, you should only listen to me. And people are doing that, right? And they're tuning out the facts. And so that's a pretty scary place to be.
Another one is that you talked about is the savior. I'm the only one who can help you.
Oh, yeah. So abusers often talk about, they don't say it quite this way, although some do, making over people, right? Like, they say to their partners, you'd be better if you did these five things, and I'm going to help you do this so that you're kind of an acceptable person. So they want to be able to come in and save people. The problem is, in order to save someone, they have to be saved from something, right? And so in order to save someone from something, you first have to destroy it. And that's what we are seeing now, right? The destruction of our institutions and our agencies. The people who are in charge of, the person in charge of the EPA has been suing the EPA, right? The person in charge of education has been, public education has been trying to get rid of it for years. And it goes on and on. People who don't believe in contraception are heading up the office in charge of contraception. So in every case, right, our institutions are being destroyed, from the State Department to the EPA, to the Department of Education and more. And then presumably someone will come along to save it, but it will be saved in the way that benefits them and that does not benefit us. And many of us won't remember what it was like when those things worked well.
Okay.
So I think that, in fact, we need only to look at families who have experienced violence to see what happened to them in order to know what could happen to us. People with an abusive mentality are destructive to themselves and to others, and it's not always easy or even possible to fix what they've broken. And that's why it's important that we begin to see that right now. So an abuser often renders a home, which is a place that's supposedly secure, so unsafe that people can't live there. And I think one day it's possible that that same situation could confront us if we don't take action now. Because when an abusive mindset is in charge, we're all at risk. So we therefore have to expose it, identify the people who carry it, examine its consequences, and then decide how we're going to resist, if not change it. And I think that, you mentioned that this book was a little depressing, but at the end, it was less so, because I have a lot of hope for what we can do to resist abusive power, and we could start right now.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.